This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the civil rights movement shook American racial apartheid to its foundations, inflicting profound defeats on white supremacy. But the defenders of the old racial regime have turned that history into a feather in the cap of American exceptionalism. And the Pennsylvania prison system is using a dubious alleged drug-induced health crisis to impose unprecedented restrictions on inmate mail and visitation.
But first, Israel is the only nuclear power on earth that has not only refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, but enforces a vow of silence on U.S. presidents from both political parties. The Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research on Middle Eastern Policy has filed suit in federal court to make public letters that the New Yorker magazine says every president since Bill Clinton has signed, promising to never publicly discuss Israel's arsenals of nuclear weapons or to pressure Israel to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We spoke with Grant Smith, director of the Institute, and asked him, how could it be that for two generations, all discussion of Israeli nukes has been forbidden in official Washington?
I think it's a function of a number of different desires, in particular on the part of Israel lobbying organizations in this country who are working to advance the Israeli position that the whole question of whether Israel has nuclear weapons or not is off the table. And there are a number of benefits for Israel to never confirm nor deny that they have nuclear weapons. One of those reasons is that any country that hasn't signed the treaty on the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, that the U.S. has basically browbeated every country into signing, but Israel is not a signatory, technically under U.S. law, the Arms Export Control Act, the United States cannot give foreign aid to such countries. Non-NNPT signatory can't receive U.S. foreign aid if they're found to have a nuclear weapons program absent some additional protocols. Another reason is that the entire question opens up embarrassing lines of inquiry, such as exactly where, when, and how did Israel acquire nuclear weapons? There have been at least two high Central Intelligence Agency officials, among other sources, who have confirmed that the Israelis obtained weapons-grade uranium from, of all places, a U.S. Atomic Energy Agency contractor in Pennsylvania with the help of the plant owners. And so the Israelis don't want to discuss how they might have come to actually assemble nuclear weapons in the 1960s, the latter part of the 1960s. So there are a whole number of reasons that Israel doesn't want this entire subject to be talked about. But what Americans should ask themselves is, why are their leaders, why are their elected officials going along with this whole thing?
Yes, one can see why Israel would see great advantages in having its nuclear weapons force shrouded in secrecy. But what's the advantage to the United States? Why have successive U.S. administrations gone along with this charade?
Well, one of the reasons we believe, and we filed a number of Freedom of Information Act lawsuits at the Institute for Research looking for secret documents to explain just that question. And it basically boils down to, for at least Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and even Donald Trump, they have all agreed to keep this issue off the table in secret letters issued early in their administrations to the Israelis, stating that they will not bring up the subject. Now, I would argue, and the evidence suggests, that there is no reason or benefit to the United States to be dishonest about this proliferation in the Middle East and to continue to pretend and even ban federal agency employees under penalty of prosecution from even talking about this. The main benefit goes to the administration. If the administration and its party that's backing it wants to continue to have access to vast amounts of coordinated pro-Israel campaign contributions, then they can't go against the lobby and Israel on this most sacred of issues. Many authors and studies have observed, from J.J. Goldberg to others, that up to 50% of any party's campaign contributions are from what are assumed to be pro-Israel Jewish donors, and they absolutely do not want either party to alienate such a key constituency to their party, their election prospects, and all of the hopes for a successful administration. And that is why, according to recent research reports and according to our last lawsuit, they have issued a series of letters early in their administration promising that this entire issue will be off the table. There are many downsides for American policy, obviously. There are few countries in the world, and in particular in the Middle East, that view the United States as a true champion of nuclear nonproliferation, because there's this giant asterisk below the U.S. demands that there be no further entries into the nuclear weapons holding club, and that asterisk is Israel. The United States and Israel have shielded the continued deployment of an Israeli triad involving aircraft, mostly supplied by the U.S., missiles, mostly developed by Israel, and submarines, mostly provided by the Germans, onto which the Israelis have allegedly mounted their nuclear first and second strike capabilities. So the United States really doesn't have any credibility in this arena. It's particularly galling and may even lead to or have led to some of the laughter involving Donald Trump's presentation at the UN. The United States is simply not a champion of nonproliferation when it has continued to ignore and, in fact, even allow the continued flow of know-how and nuclear weapons development technologies to Israel. A number of lawsuits that we filed have actually yielded reports that no journalists have ever pursued. One of them detailed the fact that Israel's nuclear production facilities are almost a mirror image of the United States nuclear weapons production laboratories, that the Israelis were working on codes to develop hydrogen bombs in the 1980s, and that the amounts of continued development, including accessing funds from nonprofit charities based in the U.S., sending over hundreds of millions of dollars to Israel, were ongoing, all without a peep from the so-called nonproliferation nuclear expert think tank community or administration officials. And if people want to read that report that we had to sue the Department of Defense to get back in 2015, it's called Critical Technology Assessment in Israel and NATO Nations. the Department of Defense fought tooth and nails not to release that detailed report on the Israeli nuclear weapons infrastructure, but they lost only because of an exceptional judge in the D.C. Circuit named Tanya Chutkin.
The United States is the superpower that has guaranteed Israel's security since the founding of that nation. Israel is the size of New Jersey, and yet we have these successive presidents signing this piece of paper that you say exists that is only in the interests of Israel. There seems the framing of this smacks of some kind of extortion or compulsion.
Well, it is very suspicious, and I believe you're absolutely right that the U.S. has been a major backer of Israel, but it wasn't always unconditional. You had President Truman, of course, immediately recognizing Israel because, as he put it, he was highly dependent upon this donor community I just talked about. You had Dwight Eisenhower, who forced the Israelis and the French and the U.K. out of Egypt, even after the Israelis launched a false flag terrorist attack on U.S. information agency officials trying to frame the Egyptians in Cairo, because he said that it was up to the Egyptians to manage the future of the Suez Canal. You had John F. Kennedy ardently fighting the Israelis not to go nuclear, sending inspectors over to inspect Dimona, but being fooled by the Israelis, while simultaneously demanding and having his Justice Department order the top Israel lobby organization, the American Zionist Council, to register as an Israeli foreign agent. History would have been different if he had not died in 1963. But only with the entrance of Johnson and finally Nixon, who was convinced by Henry Kissinger that Israel could be a Cold War asset to drive the Soviets out of the Middle East, did Israel begin to receive a flood of U.S. military support. And the Israel lobby suddenly became extremely effective from that point onward of guaranteeing and turning that into what you could call an entitlement program, the biggest in American foreign policy. It outstrips all foreign aid given to any country since it was founded, nearly $250 billion in inflation-adjusted terms since 1948, turning that into an entitlement that has continued even after the demise of the Soviet Union, which was the original Kissinger justification for arming up Israel. So these letters represent a new phase in which it's clear that Israel, even among its most ardent intellectuals, is not really a strategic asset to the United States. But this lobby, which just the nonprofit sector alone of pro-Israel organizations that have its advancements as a primary objective, will be reaching $6.3 billion worth of revenue collectively in the United States by 2020. This gigantic lobby is able to advance Israel in the United States regardless of what current thinking about national security is, and despite the fact that it's become clear that, according to Professors Mearsheimer and Walt and the 9/11 terrorist attack report, the treatment of the Palestinians is a major driver of U.S. being targeted for terrorism and international efforts against it in the region. So not a strategic asset, but definitely continuing to receive largesse as though it were.
Has received, in fact, more largesse than any other country in the world, $222 billion since the founding of Israel. But your organization maintains that this continued funding of Israel is, under these circumstances, illegal.
Absolutely. You know, we've approached this question over the past 15 years of really trying to understand what's driving U.S. policy. And as opposed to just accepting, again, the justifications from the large array of D.C.-based think tanks that are constantly touting Israel as a worthy recipient, we've really looked at campaign contributions, coordinated PAC contributions, how dissenters such as Paul Findlay and others have been ousted from elected positions if they've tried to steer a more, I would say, fair course in the policy arena. And so as you look at what's really driving policy, and as you listen to some of those experts, one of whom we hosted in one of our first conferences on the subject, made it very clear that she was in fact a target because she was questioning the entire basis of U.S. support. That was Cynthia McKinney, of course. You find out that it's really a function of a closed loop between behind-the-scenes lobbying and campaign contributions, vetting candidates, ousting dissenters like Cynthia McKinney, like Paul Findlay, and maintaining a reputation of invulnerability that it's absolutely taboo to question what Israel is doing in this country or in the region. And so when we look at the aid figures, one thing that becomes apparent is that there's also a vast component of black budget support for Israel run through intelligence agencies that makes the figure that you just cited not even quite there. Those are publicly known aid transfers, and yet there's an entirely separate intelligence component where U.S. intelligence agencies, now there are 16 of them with the CIA at the lead, are funneling additional billions to the Israelis, but they will not talk about it. So the closed loop is really between the campaign contributors, the lobbies that coordinate campaign contributions like the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and the politicians working against more sensible policies. And then there's, of course, an entire phalanx of Israel advocacy media watchdog groups that will quickly clamp down on any publication or outlet that dares venture into this territory with threats to advertisers and supporters and demands that they stop reporting on what's really driving U.S. Middle East policy and why the U.S. has effectively been tied to the oppressor, in this case, the ethnic cleansing party, of a longstanding dispute that could have been resolved decades ago if only there had been a fair chance by neutral parties, particularly within the UN, to resolve the issue. And so you have the U.S. tied to an increasingly bellicose, racist regime, which is making demands for ever greater U.S. military presence in the region, parts of the lobby asking the U.S. to attack Iran because it's allegedly challenging Israel's strategic position in the region, limiting the debates on nuclear proliferation to only countries that don't have nuclear weapons programs as opposed to the only country that does. It's becoming an increasingly dire situation as the only policymaker voices in Washington are those backed by the lobby. And of course, I'd put Nikki Haley and John Bolton as two of the top and most obvious voices, but there are many, many others.
That was Grant Smith, director of the Institute for Research on Middle Eastern Policy in Washington, D.C.